welcome to the second episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. In order to maintain the anonymity of the individuals concerned in these stories, names, places, and identifying features have been altered where appropriate. Therefore, any resemblance to individuals living or dead is purely coincidental. Although necessary details have been changed, these stories are based on actual events. They are real tragedies suffered by real people in real hospitals and clinics throughout England and Wales. Doctors trained in the United Kingdom usually graduate after 5 or 6 years. They are then enrolled into the Foundation Doctor system, where they are scattered across the country, filling all manner of medical roles. After completing 2 years of Foundation training, doctors may choose to focus their work and apply to core or specialty training. It is a luxury of our system that there is so much to choose from. You can study cancer and become an oncologist. You can study the skin and become a dermatologist. There is surgery and radiology and psychiatry and cardiology. The list goes on and on. Each and every specialty has its own challenges and virtues depending on the problems each one aims to solve. So it is hardly surprising that the spectrum of personalities is equally diverse. For example, pediatric doctors dedicate their lives to engaging with children, so their expressions may be vivid and their personalities bright. Pathologists spend their time dissecting the deceased and examining specimens in the solitude of the world revealed by their microscopes. In their endless pursuit of the cause of patient death, quite naturally their job takes them away from the living. In all the careers that doctors may be offered, the one I find most remarkable is emergency medicine. Everything else, by comparison, is superfluous, because nothing is more vital than an immediate emergency. They spend their careers in the heat of a department that is akin to a battlefield. For all their expertise and hard-earned experience, nothing will ever be made on their terms. Emergencies do not wait. Doctors are tasked with saving patients' lives, but none will fail more than those who have chosen a career in emergency medicine. And if they can handle the immensity of that pressure, they are then subjected to the insatiable demands that the public impose on them, with arbitrary targets kept at the edge of their reach. So the next time you find yourself in an emergency department, take a good look around and search for the ones who have survived to seniority. They are the bravest and most resilient of us all. And yet, despite their great strengths, even the toughest will occasionally be tested. Every now and then, something they see will be so unexpected, so lurid and perverse, that they briefly regress to a mortal mentality. Moments like these do not come often throughout the course of a career, but occasionally they will meet with a nightmare that is capable of knocking them cleanly off their feet. It was a warm spring morning when a tall young man limped into an East London accident and emergency department. A slow morning breeze blew across the hospital car park, while a few lazy clouds meandered across the sky. No sirens were heard, only the rumble of distant traffic and the noise of children playing in a neighbouring street. Two paramedics smoked cigarettes beside their idle ambulance. They squinted at the tall man, who hobbled along into the emergency department entrance. He moved past them carefully, dragging his leg in a curiously painless fashion. It was almost as though there was a weight he carried with it, something that didn't quite belong to his body. A dirty red cap was pulled low across his face. At that time, the emergency department was running smoothly, and just a handful of patients were scattered across the waiting room. An anxious-looking younger lady sat up rigidly in her chair. A well-built, bald man winced while nursing his shoulder. Spread out over several chairs was a dishevelled older man who filled out his corner with the stench of cheap booze and vomit. Amongst them were several others waiting eagerly to be seen. The man with the red cap introduced himself to the receptionist. She prodded at her keyboard, not seeing the pain in his haunted eyes. He hobbled over to a chair and dropped himself into it. He drew his cap lower and pulled up his hoodie. A few minutes passed before the man's name was called. He ambled over to an office to see the triage nurse. She asked him a few questions, and he answered them slowly. "It's my head," he said suddenly in a low, urgent whisper. "There's something wrong with my head." The nurse listened gravely, urging him on, but the man seemed reluctant to elaborate any further. When she motioned towards him, as if to remove his cap, he slapped away her hand in apologetic horror, before desperately pleading with the nurse to please just make it stop. The nurse looked at him uncertainly, considering the need for a security presence. But then she saw something that focused her attention. His bloodshot eyes looked like they'd never known sleep, but matted in his eyebrow were the remains of dried blood. He looked at her desperately from under his cap, while a fresh thread of blood trickled down across his forehead. When she earnestly asked him to take off his cap, he sunk down despairingly, hiding his face as he wept into his hands. The nurse called for help. The emergency consultant came, along with her entourage. Two attending nurses lifted the patient who had slipped from his chair, while a junior doctor scribbled awkwardly on his clipboard as he slunk into the room. The consultant smiled and crouched down beside the man. She talked to him kindly while he moaned into his hands. But her voice was gentle, and the man began to listen. He gradually released the grip on his face and lifted his eyes to meet with the doctor's. "I'm going to take your cap off," she said to him simply. His face tightened but nodded. She took the cap in her hands and slid it slowly from his head. When she saw what it hid, her decades of experience were melted by fear. She pushed away gasping and stumbled backwards on the floor. The junior doctor whimpered, his clipboard and papers slipping easily from his fingers, while the nurses stepped breathlessly away to the door. 1 year earlier, the man with the red cap experienced something that had changed his life forever. Ned stirred irritably from his sleep, with a pounding headache that beat away like a drum. He was annoyed at being woken by the sound of others laughing, and he had a headache from a beating he had taken just a few days before. Ned was addicted to football, cocaine, and violence. Every weekend in season, he would meet with his friends on the street outside pubs. In Drury Park Commons, they gathered into bands that amassed into mobs. Their noxious mobs would hover by one another, spitting and screaming, before some unseen signal caused the groups to coalesce, to form a single great mass of bloodied fists and dull grunts. As well as a pounding head, Ned had several cracked ribs, and nursed a wound along his knuckles that oozed pus into the bandage that he'd wrapped around his hand. The human mouth is a toxic jungle inhabited by microorganisms. A bite wound is one way to give them to another, but a punch that is strong enough to break your skin on their teeth is just a sure way to transport the poison. The pain that Ned felt was soothed by the knowledge that he had inflicted far more. He pictured himself fighting the previous weekend, surrounded by his friends, fellow fans, brothers. His fists clenched repeatedly as the memory made him glow. They had been outnumbered, frighteningly outnumbered, but in the heat of his fury, Ned carried a strength that made him worth 10. As the enemy closed in, one came straight for Ned, but Ned lunged forward and picked him up with one hand, throwing him backwards as if he were a toy. His allies were encouraged, and flew forward into the others, while Ned strode onwards towards his fallen foe, a pale-faced youth who was not yet a man. The gasping boy looked up at Ned through a tangle of red hair. Then his neck was snapped backwards, pinned to the ground by a hand around his throat, as Ned's bony fist began smashing into his face. The boy began to scream, as Ned crushed his nose flat against his face. The boy's grasping hands barely reached Ned's straightened elbow. His flailing arms went limp, but Ned's heavy fist hammered down unperturbed. It took three other men to pull him off the bloodied boy. Ned picked out the broken teeth embedded in his knuckles before an unseen fist struck his own head in turn. A fresh wave of laughter cut through the memory. Ned rubbed his throbbing head from the comfort of his pillow. He could handle the pain. It was the incessant chatter he found harder to tolerate. He rose wearily from his bed, rubbed his eyes, and yawned. The voice was muffled, and yet somehow it was loud. The words were spoken quickly, at times almost urgently, and at regular intervals they collapsed into laughter. He could only hear snatches of real words amongst the noise, but he could sense the mocking tone and the intermittent laughter. Ned listened through the walls to ascertain the source. Then he glared out the window at the car park that was shadowed by the tower block he lived in. His flat was at the ground floor of a grim concrete tower that reached up towards the sky, blocking out the sun. He went outside and stood in its shadow, studying the car park, scanning for the voice that had woken him from his sleep. A large grey van was parked just outside. Its windows were blacked out. Ned scrutinized it carefully, before the voice crescendoed into a fit of shrieking laughter. It allowed Ned to detect a vague sense of proximity. He turned his attention back inside the building. The voice wasn't just muffled, it sounded almost crackled, almost like a radio station that's been incorrectly tuned. With that realization, the voice stopped abruptly. Ned gratefully exhaled and smiled with closed eyes. It must have been a radio, and now someone's turned it off. 1 week later, the voice returned. Ned was lying on his sofa, staring at a television that was equally mindless. His hand seemed to move independently of his body, attacking a controller that lived out vicious fantasies through Ned's video games. A steady stream of smoke rose up from his ashtray, while the rattle of rain pattered constantly through the windows. The low murmur of the voice broke Ned from his trance. He turned off his television and noiselessly extinguished his cigarette into a beer can. Getting quietly to his feet, he crept around his flat in furious silence, waiting to hear snatches that would lead him to its source. When the voice drew him in circles, Ned began to wonder if he was being targeted in a simple childish prank. He even considered the possibility that the crackled noise came from speakers concealed throughout his flat. For what purpose, he couldn't say, but he couldn't come up with any other plausible explanation. He fiddled with his electronics and checked the backs of furniture, but nothing was amiss, and no speaker or microphone was convincingly seen. Ned put his ear to every wall and listened closely through the open windows. But once again, he couldn't determine from where the noise came. Every neighbor in his vicinity earned an impatient visit, and when he was met with only shrugs, he once again turned his attention outdoors. He scrutinized the car park from his dirty kitchen window, throwing suspicious glances to all the damp passers-by. The lofty tower block began to feel a weight above his head, but he continued his search as the voice carried on. Meanwhile, the rain was growing in weight, now coming down in heavy lashes. then through the blurred, muddy shadows. Ned's twitching glances suddenly became fixed. The large, grey van. Seeing it for the second time resonated slowly with Ned. It took a moment for the image to make sense in his mind. The van was parked differently, but it was definitely the same van that he'd seen the week before. The voice rose up, both in anger and volume, suddenly speaking to him with startling clarity. "I'm going to rip out your throat," the voice barked harshly. "You're as good as dead now, United scumbag." The insults came in hard and Ned began to panic. His tremulous mind settled on the van, frozen in focus as it suddenly made sense to him. He instinctively reached out to pull the curtain shut, narrowing his gaze through the crack in between them. "The next time I see you, I will split your face in two." Ned blocked his ears and the voice was quickly silenced, but in the very same moment the van's engine began to rev. Its headlights shone straight at him, sending shadows through his flat. Then it pulled out the car park, slipping quietly away. Ned worked in a flower stall, selling roses out of buckets by the side of a rail station. The following morning, the weather had cleared and the sky gleamed blue. Business was good. Most who came by knew exactly what they wanted. Then there were the time wasters who would finger every stem before leaving without a word. And then there were the commuters who Ned relied on to offload his dead and broken. Every now and then he'd get a guilty-faced male who'd look around cluelessly and take whatever Ned gave them. But best of all was the customer who gave a thick wad of banknotes handed over to Ned in the form of a handshake. For this he'd return his dreariest bouquet, within which was hidden a packet of cocaine. It was the early hours of morning by the time Ned was home. His body was trembling, and his mind was on fire, lit by a cocktail of LSD, cocaine, cannabis, and beer. But now came the come down, and he needed his bed. Ned pushed his door key in through the lock, but the door began to open before he had even turned it. He staggered inside to find his home had been ransacked. Anything of value had been taken, and all the furniture he owned had been slashed to pieces by knives. He ran into his bedroom, searching for the one thing that was of real value to Ned. The sight of his torn mattress made him cry out despairingly, but he slid his whole arm into its open gash. He pulled out clumps of foam, layers of rubber and springs. But even in the midst of his intoxicated grief, Ned already knew that the money hidden there was gone. Most of it he had stolen or illicitly gained, but it was £30,000 and every penny had been taken. Ned staggered backwards and nearly slipped on something soft. He looked down to see that he stood ankle deep in a pile of human excrement. And then he saw something that turned the dagger in his heart. Huge brown words were scrawled out across the wall. "United scumbag." As Ned fell to the floor, a glimpse out the window formed an image in his mind. Beams shone from the headlights of the large grey van. Ned passed out before his head hit the floor. The following morning, Ned contacted the authority that he respected most, spreading the news quickly through his hooligan community. The reference to their football club meant only one thing. This had to have been a rival, and so on their bleak battlefield, they would take their revenge. Ned's flat was soon packed with busy men and women, each proudly bearing his beloved United red. The floors were swept, the wall repainted, and his broken belongings were replaced with donations. Ned looked at the wall where the message had been. The best thing they could have done was to make the attack personal. He shook many different hands and his shoulders ached from the countless kindly pats, but Ned couldn't shake the feeling that his troubles were far from done. He stood by a window, speaking to a member of his hooligan crew, a grizzled older male who, on hearing the news, had summoned the club's help. While chatting with the older man, Ned watched a lean-limbed youth carrying bin bags outside. The boy wore a red cap, beneath which protruded jagged streaks of shaggy red hair. As Ned watched the boy, an ember of recognition glowed. Ned interrupted his conversation to tap the window urgently. The youth turned hesitantly, showing glimpses of his face that was concealed in a scarf. He gave an awkward thumbs up, then went on his way with his cargo of bin bags. Ned knew that tangled red hair. He was the pale-faced youth whose face he had disfigured. Even friends winced at his savagery that day, but that was not Ned's present concern. Why was the boy here, disguised as one of his own? Ned's visitors left him in a state of unease, comprehensively disturbed by the recent events and crushed by the poverty that the burglary had caused him. He drifted through the night, never truly finding sleep, until an unexpected smell brought him sharply to his senses. Ned was overwhelmed by a pungent wave of cannabis. He rolled onto his back and frowned at the intrusion. His eye was drawn to the relative darkness in the corner of his bedroom, where a tiny orange glow had captured his attention. He stared at it sleepily, then it moved and grew brighter, before rapidly returning to its original position. Ned froze in his bed. A surge of adrenaline pulsed through his body. His heart picked up speed, and his skin was glazed with sweat. That tiny orange glow was suddenly unmistakable. Someone was in his room, sitting and smoking while Ned had been sleeping. What Ned had seen paralyzed him where he lay. His unblinking gaze was fixed, and his heart seemed ready to burst from his chest. But what happened next surprised him most of all. The intruder did nothing. Hours passed by until the glow of the cigarette dissolved into the darkness. The paralyzing strain exhausted Ned's senses, and he drifted fretfully into a troubled sleep. When he woke the next morning, the intruder had gone. The only sign of his presence was a scattering of cigarette ash in the corner of the bedroom. Ned struggled through the day, selling flowers in the rain. He returned home in the evening with a new, wary fear. He numbed his anxiety with alcohol and cannabis, collapsing onto his bed into an imitation of sleep. He woke in the darkness to the same smell again, but this time it was different. There was also a low murmuring of the voice he'd grown to know. He turned in his bed to see the familiar orange glow. He painfully stared at it through exhausted, moist eyes, immediately stricken by its irresistible paralysis. The intruder kept whispering an incoherent nonsense, intermittently collapsing into the familiar childish giggle. The intruder's monologue drifted vaguely into something that Ned could understand. The voice began to taunt Ned for his pitiful existence. It listed the failures of his childhood, all the failed relationships of his girlfriends and of family, and the failures of one thing that Ned really cared for, his beloved football club. The voice then became earnest, carefully explaining how easy it had been to infiltrate Ned's life, to find his spare key, to access his flat, to install speakers and cameras, to locate the money in his mattress. The voice almost took on a paternalistic tone. Ned could only lay and listen, unmoving except for his stuttered gasping breaths and the silent tears that spilled across his cheeks. He fell asleep listening to a recital of his failures. The intruder's nightly visits tormented Ned frequently over the course of a year. His fear of the darkness never diminished, despite the repetitive messages of every haunting meeting. But one night the intruder did something differently. It started as it had done. Ned woke to the familiar portending smell and the unnerving sensation of being closely watched. He turned in his bed to see the smoking orange dot in an unexpected position. This time it was closer, much closer than he was used to seeing. His eyes adjusted in the dark, and he saw the intruder standing over him in his bed. Ned saw the glow move as the intruder lifted the cigarette to his mouth. The intruder sucked, intensifying the glow to illuminate them both. Jagged strands of red hair framed a ghostly white face. "It's the boy," Ned realized, his disfigured face mummified in tightly wrapped bandages. The boy's mouth moved, and he spoke to Ned slowly. "Now it's time for you to pay." The boy dropped his cigarette and trotted into the floor. The room returned to darkness, and Ned was left with his remaining senses. First, he heard the gentle clink of metal. He even detected its scent in the air, a metallic trace of iron he could taste on his tongue. The next thing he knew was a terrible pain, an absurd violation. A blinding light that turned the darkness into nothing. Ned was not dreaming. His nightmares were real. That he survived that night was a miracle of the biblical sort. He gradually woke with a tenuous grip on consciousness. Understanding what had happened, he knew every moment that passed may well be his last. His left arm and leg would only move sluggishly. His only remaining thought was to seek medical help. When the emergency consultant removed the cap from his head, Ned collapsed into his seat. His failing mind and body could no longer support him. Once the medical team overcame their own horror, they quickly set about to save Ned's life. There were 8 iron nails which had been hammered into Ned's skull. The largest of these measured 11 centimeters in length. Once Ned was resuscitated, he was taken to an operating theater by a team of neurosurgeons who removed each nail under general anesthesia. As the doctors unraveled the details in his story, it soon became apparent that Ned had been suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. After recovering from his operation, Ned was admitted to a psychiatric hospital, who carefully cared for his fragile mental health. Ned's case is remarkable in that he made a near total recovery. The most significant physical damage caused by the nails resulted in isolated damage to a region of his brain responsible for motor function. While this left him with slightly reduced power in his left arm and leg, the remaining function of his brain was otherwise relatively intact. Although penetrating his brain, each one of the 8 nails had narrowly missed key anatomical structures. The largest 11-centimeter nail came within 3 millimeters of his brainstem, a central part of the brain that controls consciousness, breathing, and the contractions of the heart. 3 millimeters further would have certainly killed him. All of the nails, miraculously dissected through nerves, blood vessels, and cerebral cortices, without resulting in any fatal injuries. For the duration of his illness, Ned had been afflicted by psychotic episodes, from undiagnosed schizophrenia, exacerbated by his drug use and years of self-neglect. The intruder was a hallucination, a frightful representation of Ned's sense of guilt and anxiety. Ned was the one who went out to purchase the hammer and the nails, and Ned was the one who had mutilated himself with it. But his perceptions of the intruder had been just as convincing as any other aspect of his tortured reality. The visions and voices existed only in his mind. Everything else had been an unfortunate coincidence. The devastating burglary was the result of a drug-related dispute involving an unforgiving rival. The boy with the bin bags was nothing more than that. Ned's obsession with the van was just a delusion, a symptom of his illness. Ned's antipsychotic medication was optimized, and he was treated for his various drug addictions. He was eventually discharged back to his home, traumatized but functional. He went back to selling flowers, but only the ones that grow petals and stems. He went on to use his experiences to work with others suffering from serious and debilitating mental health conditions. He left behind his old life and embraced something new. The etymological root of the word schizophrenia comes from the Greek word schizo, to split, and phren, the mind. This refers to the state that sufferers can experience when their minds are split away from reality as hallucinations take control of their perceived universe. Generally speaking, people with paranoid schizophrenia suffer from auditory hallucinations, where voices or sounds are perceived without stimulus. Visual hallucinations, which Ned also experienced, are more commonly associated with hallucinogenic drug use brought on by illicit drugs such as LSD or cannabis. The initial symptoms of schizophrenia are often experienced in conjunction with a delusional state and loss of insight. People who suffer with this often have the strongest convictions that what they are experiencing is real. Historically, these experiences have often been associated with a total loss of functionality and the brutal marginalization to the periphery of society. Often sufferers have been institutionalized into places that have earned their negative connotations. Throughout the course of history, these places have taken on many different names. In 13th century London, there was the priory known as Bedlam. In 18th century Vienna, there was the institution known as the Fool's Tower. Other names such as Madhouse, Funny Farm, Loony Bin, and Lunatic Asylum are all historical descriptors that come with their own implications and prejudices. The medical community's understanding of schizophrenia is probably better now than it has ever been before, but there is still work to be done. All too often, people with schizophrenia will find themselves unfairly stigmatized in the media, often reported in association with dangerous behaviors or criminal activity. Meanwhile, populist expressions such as psycho, split personality, or the voices in their head do little to promote true understanding of the underlying disease process. Approximately 1% of people in the United Kingdom have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. It is a potentially devastating disease for which there is no cure. Individuals who suffer with it deserve society's compassion and understanding. But for people with this disease, there is hope to be had, because the treatments today are more effective than ever. And if carefully managed with empathy and kindness, in addition to the powerful antipsychotic medication, people like Ned can take control of their symptoms, enabling them to lead the lives they want to live. These stories deal with themes that will be challenging for some. If you're in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything.